Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin in the studios of WUWM in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
A great man in a great place on a great lake.
A great canal, Panama.
Ken, which speech did you watch?
I watched President Obama, and I also watched President Cheney.
Yes, this was the first time I can recall seeing a presidential debate between two candidates for president, one of whom was president and the other of whom was not running for anything, but actually just a former vice president who was speaking at the American Enterprise Institute.
Both were very good, I thought.
Yes, each in his own way was at his best. So if we were to look back over these two speeches and say, what were the big clashes? What do they essentially disagree about? What would you say, Ken?
Well, I would say constitutional.
Everything, pretty much everything. You know, they disagreed about absolutely everything.
They did. And actually, you know, you always talk about the snarling Dick Cheney, but Dick Cheney could not hide his contempt for the new president, for the attorney general, for the New York Times, for everybody.
In my long experience in Washington, few matters have inspired so much contrived indignation and phony moralizing as the interrogation methods applied to a few captured terrorists.
Well, he was snarling, all right.
He was, but you know something? But, I mean, it was an argument that I think holds favor with a lot of people in this country.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, this is probably one of the great, on the one hand, on the other hand, arguments not only for this moment in American history, but throughout our history and perhaps through history in general. Do you emphasize the defensive posture? Do you say we always have to be tough and we always have to be showing people how tough we are so as to discourage any sort of attacks on us? Or is there something to the idea that that sort of posture only in the end encourages people to want to attack you?
Although President Obama did say that that's a false choice.
We need not sacrifice our security for our values, nor sacrifice our values for our security, so long as we approach difficult questions with honesty and care and a dose of common sense.
I think you could say that the heart of the debate is whether or not that is a false choice, that Dick Cheney insists that it is a true choice.
And Dick Cheney also did it from the perspective of him sitting in the vice presidential office on September 11, 2001, and what he feared was coming next. So, I mean, it was almost like a you are there moment, and he explained his actions and emotions and what he decided to do about it.
Of course, there's no controversy, at least at the moment, about anything that Dick Cheney did on 9/11. Where all the controversy is, where all the heat is being generated, is about decisions that were made many months after 9/11, after they started using some of these enhanced interrogation techniques, which Dick Cheney 100% embraced in his speech on Thursday.
What this all leads to, of course, is the debate, another debate going on, and what is the proper role of a former vice president? I mean, Al Gore did criticize the Bush administration in the aftermath of 9/11, but it seems like Dick Cheney, what's interesting to me, at least the most interesting thing, is that he was so reticent, at least publicly, for much of those 8 years, and now you can't even get him off the front pages of the newspapers, let alone off the talk shows.
Oh, but in fairness, though, he's filling a vacuum. He wouldn't be doing this if George W. Bush were speaking out in public to defend his own administration. I think Dick Cheney would take the same back seat to the president that he took during the 8 years they were in office.
Yes, and President Bush said from the beginning that President Obama has my best wishes and I'm staying out of this. But what it also does, it either exposes a lack of big-name Republican so-called leaders, when you have Dick Cheney, Rush Limbaugh, and Newt Gingrich on the talk shows, as you had a couple of weeks ago, and you have them, you know, constantly in the news. You don't have any other Republican. Of course, look, President Obama has been in office for 4 months. Michael Steele, the nominal head of the Republican Party, has been in office for less than 4 months, or just about almost 4 months. So it's not that this is a long-standing trend that's going on, but at least in this four-month report card, it doesn't look so good for the GOP, in my humble opinion.
Well, Rush Limbaugh, in fact, went so far as to say he does not want to be the de facto head, and for those who are anointing him as the Republican leader, he doesn't want the honor. He doesn't want to be seen in those terms, and he thinks that those are basically just Democrats who are trying to do that anyway.
Well, if Rush Limbaugh is not the head of the Republican Party, then who's the head of the Democrat Socialist Party?
The Democrat Socialist Party was almost the official moniker that the Republican Party was going to apply to its rival. But at a meeting of the Republican National Committee this week, there was agreement that they would not use Democrat Socialist to refer to the Democratic Party. Now, interestingly, we've talked about this before, Ken, the Republicans are already using a term for the Democratic Party that is not the Democratic Party. They call it the Democrat Party.
that started with actually Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, that sneer of talking about the Democrat Party because if they're not truly Democratic. But others have picked it up as well. I mean, President Bush talked about it, although apologized for it sometimes. Newt Gingrich talked about it. Republic leaders of Congress talked about that.
And it became an irritant in and of itself, so that when George W. Bush, talking of wanting to create a more nonpartisan or bipartisan atmosphere in Washington, adopted the use of Democrat Party when he became president, that was seen as a signal to the Democrats that he didn't mean it.
Well, if it's Democrat instead of Democratic and it's Republican instead of Republican, is it Socialist Work Party? I mean, really, how far do you want to take this? Is it Libertaire Party?
I think it's safe to say, Ken Rood, that there is a sense in which all this is truly silly. But it is the nature of the debate right now. I think partly because, as you said, the Republican Party seems to have been somewhat in free fall, and they need to get traction on more substantive issues in order to get away from these kinds of who's on first, who's our leader, what should we call the other guys kind of arguments. And this week, I would argue, they started to do just that with the Guantanamo votes.
President Obama asked Congress for $80 million to help close Guantanamo without any plan of what to do with the 200-plus detainees who were there. And Republicans say, wait, do we want these terrorists on our shores? Now, the Democrats actually knuckled under that as well and said, wait a second, this could turn out to be an awful issue for us, given that how many times Republicans have blasted us for being soft on national security. So the Democratic Congress, basically embarrassed by the Republicans, seemed to say to President Obama, we're not accepting your Guantanamo plan as given.
Oh, they bailed on him, and they bailed on him big time, both House and Senate. And in the Senate, they've actually piled on a couple of other amendments, even on top of the $80 million being withheld, making it even more difficult, possibly even difficult to bring any of the detainees to the United States to try. That one's still up in the air. What's happened here is that the vaunted, and let's face it, they've earned it, Obama political operation failed to sense that the deterioration of their position on this issue in the Senate was just complete. They knew the Republicans were all over it, and they knew the Republicans were giving daily speeches about it, but they failed to see that the Democrats were going to just absolutely go south on them. When Dan Inouye, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, who hardly ever engenders any publicity intentionally, he comes out and says, we're not going to do this, and the president really hasn't given us a plan, that's a real slap in the face, and I hope the White House realizes just how badly they fumbled the ball here.
One thing that could give the Republicans another boost is the upcoming fight, and it's already begun, even though we don't have a nominee yet, the upcoming fight on who's going to replace David Souter on the Supreme Court.
Yes, and the Republicans are already finding, I think, a lot of unity in their assumption that whoever the president nominates will be somebody who is relatively liberal compared certainly to the last couple of choices that George W. Bush made, and that they will be able to unite their party in opposition to judges they will characterize not only as liberal but as something much, much worse, activists.
Obviously, the fight would be far more intense had a moderate or a conservative be retiring, and then President Obama would replace somebody like that. Trading David Souter for another liberal doesn't change the ideological makeup of the court.
But it can be portrayed as such. Because even if David Souter always voted with the liberal bloc, whomever is nominated by Barack Obama will be portrayed not as a member of the liberal bloc, but as some kind of new, scary radical.
One of the big debates going on in the Republican Party was exemplified by an op-ed this week by Ed Gillespie, former chairman of the Republican National Committee, who talks about how the Republicans should respond to this Supreme Court nomination battle. Do they acquiesce in the way they did in 1993 with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's nomination when there was hardly any opposition to her, and 1994 with Stephen Breyer, hardly any opposition to him? And or should they be like the Democrats were with John Roberts and Samuel Alito when 42 members of the Senate voted against Alito? Matter of fact, Barack Obama was part of a contingent of senators who want to do filibuster the nomination. So I think there are some Republicans who say, look, if it's okay for the left, for the liberals, for the Democrats to try to filibuster a nomination, why shouldn't we be just equally as ideologically insistent?
And I suspect they will be. Do you not?
I do. But I think I have a prediction. I think it's going to be Diane Wood.
I think a lot of people believe it will be Diane Wood. She was at a conference here this week. She sat next to Nina Totenberg. I think that pretty much tells the
rules her out.
Nina asked her if she had been interviewed yet by the president, and I thought she had a very good response. Nice to meet you. I have to go.
All right. We don't have a Supreme Court nominee yet, but we do have an ambassador to China nominee yet, and somebody who was a potential 2012 Republican presidential candidate.
Ken, I think actually you wrote about this in your blog, and you made some good points. That John.
Wait,
Huntsman,
you read it? You read my blog?
I read it every day. And you made some good points, I think, about Huntsman, because I don't think that he was necessarily in that many people's minds as a very likely Republican nominee in 2012 until this moment comes along when he was named to be envoy to China and everyone all of a sudden said, well, of course, he's eminently qualified for this. He speaks Chinese. He's been working on trade issues with the Chinese for decades. He really knows the country. But the real reason the president did it was to snooker the Republicans out of their best nominee against him in 2012. I think that's
Isn't that silly? That is so silly. I agree with that completely. But what it does do, it just, first of all, one, it does signal his willingness to reach across party lines. And John Huntsman, actually, his biggest problems were with conservative Republicans in Utah, and most of it is about civil unions. John Huntsman supports civil unions. He opposes same-sex marriage, but that was still not good enough for many conservatives. And had Huntsman sought a third term in 2012, he could very well have faced serious opposition at the state convention. Meanwhile, it takes him out of the running for at least another term as governor.
Well, let's just say that down the road, perhaps 2016, 2020, there might be a presidential sweepstakes in which John Huntsman might be back, might play a role.
Yeah, that's 2016 hindsight.
Okay, we don't have to talk about 2016, 2020 because...
Wait. If you don't want to talk about 2016 and 2020, we should talk about 2008, and that is Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama, and they're still fighting that race. Where?
Virginia.
That's right.
Where surrogates are still battling it out.
Terry McAuliffe, the former Democratic National Chair and longtime Clinton loyalist, is the big target, at least with Brian Moran, another Democrat who's running for the Democratic nomination for governor in the June 9th primary. Terry McAuliffe, of course, stayed with Hillary Clinton well after her viability as a Democratic presidential candidate was over. And Brian Moran is trying to make a blatant appeal to African-American voters for the June 9th primary.
The truth is, Terry McAuliffe led the campaign that ran the 3 a.m. attack ad against Barack Obama. McAuliffe worked to put up the ads that questioned Obama's ability to be president.
He's really trying to make his contest with Terry McAuliffe about the Obama-Clinton struggle of a year ago. And it's a tremendous reach, although it is, of course, fair to say Terry McAuliffe was very much a Clinton supporter. He rose with the Clintons in the 90s.
And there are people who just say that, you know, he's an opportunist. People didn't even know he lived in Virginia. In his ads, he's talking about creating jobs. And a lot of people say, what jobs could he possibly have created?
I consider it my job to protect your job. I think that's a pretty good political slogan.
We also haven't talked about Cree Deeds, Democratic State Senator, the third Democrat in that primary race, but it seems like it's between Terry McAuliffe and not Terry McAuliffe, and ultimately whoever wins that will face Bob McDonnell, the former Republican Attorney General, in November. So meanwhile, while the Democrats are fighting it out in Virginia 1 week earlier, Republicans are fighting it out in New Jersey.
June 2nd, a primary there between two Republicans and no real primary on the Democratic side.
John Corzine is seeking a second term, trailing in the polls to his likely Republican candidate, Chris Christie, the former U.S. attorney. And so a lot of Democrats would love to see Christie's opponent in the June 2nd primary win the nomination because he's far more conservative and probably far more beatable in November. But I think Corzine will have a fight on his hands. If Corzine loses in November, he'd be the first Democrat to lose since Jim Florio lost
Jim
in 1989.
Florio, yeah.
Wherefore art thou, Florio?
Florio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all right. Whoever the Republicans nominate in New Jersey, Corzine's got serious problems. He's being blamed for the bad economy in New Jersey. He has never really gotten the hearts and minds of New Jerseyans. He's been surviving largely on the blueness of the state and the greenness of his own wallet.
That's very true.
All right. In Southern California, as we talked about last week, a previously Hispanic district, it had been Martinez's
for 27
district,
years,
Hilda
27 years Hispanic
district, is now going to have a Chinese-American representative because in the runoff between the number one and number two finisher, we have Judy Chu, the Democratic candidate, and Betty Chu, the Republican candidate. Big surprise here is not that it's two women. It's that it's two people, neither of whom is Hispanic.
The problem is in the initial primary last Tuesday, you had several Hispanics splitting the Latino vote. Gil Cedillo, who's a state senator, a lot of people thought he had a shot, but there were other Hispanics in the race and allowed Judy Chu to win. I mean, I think journalists made a bigger deal of this than it actually turned out to be because there were no seriously overt appeals to race or ethnicity, but it is interesting that a district, the 32nd congressional district, that has had a Latino member of Congress since 1982 is now going to be an Asian American member of Congress.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin in the great state of Wisconsin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Choo-choo, 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 choo-choo